The Hadji entered the dark and turbulent channel. The blue-black rock walls rose on both sides, and the boat went down a curve, and the broad lake behind was lost. Everybody was busy then, jumping to handle the sails as Burton took the Hadji back and forth in the quarter-mile-wide stream and against a current that raised high waves. The boat rose and dipped sharply and heeled far over when they changed course abruptly. It often came within a few feet of the canyon walls, where the waves slapped massively against the rock. But he had been sailing the boat so long that he had become a part of it, and his crew had worked with him so long that they could anticipate his orders, though they never acted ahead of them. The passage took about 30 minutes. It caused anxiety in some, no doubt of Frigate and Ruach being worried, but it also exhilarated all of them. The boredom and the sullenness were, temporarily, at least, gone. The Hadji came out into the sunshine of another lake. This was about 4 miles wide and stretched northward as far as they could see. The mountains abruptly fell away. The plains on both sides resumed the usual mile width. There were 50 or so craft in view, ranging from pine dugouts to 2-masted bamboo boats. Most of them seemed to be engaged in fishing. To the left, a mile away, was the ubiquitous Grailstone, and along the shore were dark figures. Behind them, on the plain and hills, were bamboo huts in the usual style of what Frigate called Neo-Polynesian, or sometimes post-mortem riparian architecture. On the right, about 1/2 mile from the exit of the canyon, was a large log fort. Before it were 10 massive log docks with a variety of large and small boats. A few minutes after the Hadji appeared, drums began beating. These could be hollow logs, or drums made with tanned fish skin or human skin. There was already a crowd in front of the fort, but a large number swarmed out of it, and from a collection of huts behind it. They piled into the boats, and these cast off. On the left bank, the dark figures were launching dugouts, canoes, and single-masted boats. It looked as if both shores were sending boats out in a competition to seize the Hadji first. Burton took the boat back and forth as required, cutting in between the other boats several times. The men on the right were closer. They were white and well-armed, but they made no effort to use their bows. A man standing in the prow of a war canoe with 30 paddlers shouted at them in German to surrender. "You will not be harmed." "We come in peace," Frigate bawled at him. "He knows that," Burton said. "It's evident that we few aren't going to attack them." Drums were beating on both sides of the river now. It sounded as if the lake shores were alive with drums, and the shores were certainly alive with men, all armed. Other boats were being put out to intercept them. Behind them, the boats that had first gone out were pursuing, but losing distance. Burton hesitated. Should he bring the Hadji on around and go back through the channel and then return at night? It would be a dangerous maneuver because the 20,000-foot-high walls would block out the light from the blazing stars and gas sheets. They would be almost blind. And this craft did seem to be faster than anything the enemy had. So far, that is. Far in the distance, tall sails were coming swiftly toward him. Still, they had the wind and current behind them, and if he avoided them, could they outstrip him when they too had to tack? All the vessels he had seen so far had been loaded with men, thus slowing them down. Even a boat that had the same potentialities as the Hadji would not keep up with her if she were loaded with warriors. He decided to keep on running upriver. 10 minutes later, as he was running close-hauled, another large war canoe cut across his path. This held 16 paddlers on each side and supported a small deck in the bow and the stern. 2 men stood on each deck beside a catapult mounted on a wooden pedestal. The 2 in the bow placed a round object which sputtered smoke in the pocket of the catapult. 1 pulled the catch and the arm of the machine banged against the crossbeam. The canoe shuddered, and there was a slight halt in the deep rhythmic grunting of the paddlers. The smoking object flew in a high arc until it was about 20 feet in front of the Hadji and 10 feet above the water. It exploded with a loud noise and much black smoke, quickly cleared away by the breeze. Some of the women screamed and a man shouted. He thought there is sulfur in this area, otherwise they wouldn't have been able to make gunpowder. He called to Logu and Esther Rodriguez to take over at the tiller. Both women were pale, but they seemed calm enough, although neither woman had ever experienced a bomb. Grenafra had been put inside the forecastle. Alice had a U-bow in her hand and a quiver of arrows strapped to her back. Her pale skin contrasted shockingly with the red lipstick and the green eyelid makeup, but she had been through at least 10 running battles on the water, and her nerves were as steady as the chalk cliffs of Dover. Moreover, she was the best archer of the lot. Burton was a superb marksman with a firearm, but he lacked practice with the bow. Kaz could draw the river dragon horn bow even deeper than Burton, but his marksmanship was abominable. Frigate claimed it would never be very good. Like most pre-literates, he lacked a development of the sense of perspective.